They shall not grow old. The two of us sat outside the hangar on wooden boxes. It was noon. The sun was high and the heat of the sun was like a close fire. It was hotter than hell out there by the hangar. We could feel the hot air touching the inside of our lungs when we breathed, and we found it better if we almost closed our lips and breathed in quickly. It was cooler that way. The sun was upon our shoulders and upon our backs, and all the time the sweat seeped out from our skin, trickled down our necks, over our chests and down our stomachs. It collected just where our belts were tight around the tops of our trousers, and it filtered under the tightness of our belts, where the wet was very uncomfortable and made prickly heat on the skin. Our two hurricanes were standing a few yards away, each with that patient, smug look which fighter planes have when the engine's not running, and beyond them the thin black strip of the runway sloped down towards the beaches and towards the sea. The black surface of the runway and the white grassy sand on the sides of the runway shimmered and shimmered in the sun. The heat haze hung like a vapor over the aerodrome. The stag looked at his watch. "He ought to be back," he said. The two of us were on readiness, sitting there for orders to take off. The stag moved his feet on the hot ground. "He ought to be back," he said. It was 2.5 hours since Finn had gone, and he certainly should have come back by now. I looked up into the sky and listened. There was the noise of airmen talking beside the petrol wagon, and there was the faint pounding of the sea upon the beaches, but there was no sign of an aeroplane. We sat a little while longer without speaking. "Looks as though he's had it," I said. "Yep," said the stag. "It looks like it." The stag got up and put his hands into the pockets of his khaki shorts. I got up too. We were looking northwards into the clear sky, and we shifted our feet in the ground because of the softness of the tar and because of the heat. "What was the name of that girl?" said the stag without turning his head. "Nikki," I answered. The stag sat down again on his wooden box, still with his hands in his pockets, and he looked down at the ground between his feet. The stag was the oldest pilot in the squadron. He was 27. He had a mass of coarse ginger hair which he never brushed. His face was pale, even after all this time in the sun, and covered with freckles. His mouth was wide and tight closed. He was not tall, but his shoulders under his khaki shirt were broad and thick, like those of a wrestler. He was a quiet person. "He'd probably be all right," he said, looking up. "Anyway, I'd like to meet the Vichy Frenchman who can get Finn." We were in Palestine, fighting the Vichy French in Syria. We were at Haifa, and 3 hours before the stag, Finn and I had gone in readiness. Finn had flown off in response to an urgent call from the Navy, who had phoned up and said that there were two French destroyers moving out of the Beirut harbor. "Please go at once and see where they are going," said the Navy. "Just fly up the coast and have a look and come back quickly and tell us where they are going." So Finn had flown off in his hurricane. The time had gone by and he had not returned. We knew that there was no longer much hope. If he hadn't been shot down, he would have run out of petrol some time ago. I looked down and I saw his blue RAF cap, which was lying on the ground where he had thrown it as he ran to his aircraft, and I saw the oil stains on top of the cap and the shabby bent peak. It was difficult now to believe that he had gone. He had been in Egypt, in Libya, and in Greece. On the aerodrome and in the mess, we had had him with us all of the time. He was gay and tall and full of laughter, this Finn, with black hair and a long, straight nose, which he used to stroke up and down with the tip of his finger. He had a way of listening to you while you were telling a story, leaning back in his chair with his face to the ceiling but with his eyes looking down on the ground. And it was only last night at supper that he had suddenly said, "You know, I wouldn't mind marrying Nikki. I think she's a good girl." The stag was sitting opposite him at the time, eating baked beans. "You mean just occasionally," he said. Nikki was in a cabaret in Haifa. "No," said Finn. "Cabaret girls make fine wives. They are never unfaithful. There is no novelty for them in being unfaithful. That would be like going back to the old job." The stag had looked up from his beans. "Don't be such a bloody fool," he said. "He wouldn't really marry Nikki." "Nikki," said Finn with great seriousness, Comes of a fine family. She is a good girl. She never uses a pillow when she sleeps. Do you know why she never uses a pillow when she sleeps? No. The others at the table were listening now. Everyone was listening to Finn talking about Nikki. Well? When she was very young, she was engaged to be married to an officer in the French Navy. She loved him greatly. Then one day, when they were sunbathing together on the beach, he happened to mention her that he never used a pillow when he slept. It was just one of those little things which people say to each other for the sake of conversation. But Nikki never forgot it. From that time onwards, she began to practice sleeping without a pillow. One day, the French officer was run over by a truck and killed. But although to her it was very uncomfortable, she still went on sleeping without a pillow to preserve the memory of her lover. Finn took a mouthful of beans and chewed them slowly. "It's a sad story," he said. "It shows that she is a good girl. I think I would like to marry her." That was what Finn had said last night at supper. Now he was gone. And I wondered what little thing Nikki would do in his memory. The sun was hot on my back, and I turned instinctively in order to take the heat upon the other side of my body. As I turned, I saw Carmel and the town of Haifa. I saw the steep, pale green slope of the mountain as it dropped down towards the sea, and below it I saw the town and the bright colors of the houses shining in the sun. The houses with their whitewashed walls covered the sides of Carmel, and the red roofs of the houses were like a rash on the face of the mountain. Walking slowly towards us from the grey corrugated iron hangar came the three men who were the next crew in readiness. They had their yellow May Wests slung over their shoulders, and they came walking slowly towards us, holding their helmets in their hands as they came. When they were close, the stag said, "Finn's had it." And they said, "Yes, I know." They sat down in the wooden boxes which we had been using, and immediately the sun was upon their shoulders and upon their backs, and they started to sweat. The stag and I walked away. The next day was a Sunday, and in the morning we flew up the Lebanon Valley to groundstrafe an aerodrome called Rayak. We flew past Hermann, who had a hat of snow upon his head, and we came down out of the sun onto Rayak and onto the French bombers on the aerodrome and began our strafing. I remember that as we flew past, skimming low over the ground, the doors of the French bombers opened. I remember seeing a whole lot of women in white dresses running out across the aerodrome. I remember particularly their white dresses. You see, it was a Sunday, and the French pilots had asked their ladies out from Beirut to look over the bombers. The Vichy pilots had said, "Come out on a Sunday morning and we will show you our aeroplanes." It was a very Vichy French thing for them to do. So when we started shooting, they all tumbled out and began to run across the aerodrome in their white Sunday dresses. I remember hearing Monkey's voice over the radio saying, "Give them a chance, give them a chance." And the whole squadron wheeled around and circled the aerodrome once while the women ran over the grass in every direction. One of them stumbled and fell twice, and one of them was limping and being helped by a man, but we gave them time. I remember watching the small, bright flashes of a machine gun on the ground, and thinking they should at least have stopped their shooting while we were waiting for the white-dressed women to get out of the way. That was the day after Finn had gone. The next day, the stag and I sat once more at readiness on the wooden boxes outside the hangar. Paddy, a big fair-haired boy, had taken Finn's place and was sitting with us. It was noon. The sun was high, and the heat of the sun was like a close fire. The sweat ran down our necks, down the inside of our shirts, over our chests and stomachs, and we sat there waiting for the time when we would be relieved. The stag was sewing the strap onto his helmet with a needle and cotton, and telling of how he had seen Nikki the night before in Haifa, and of how he had told her about Finn. Suddenly we heard the noise of an aeroplane. The stag stopped his talking, and we all looked up. The noise was coming from the north, and it grew louder and louder as the aeroplane flew closer. And then the stag said suddenly, "It's a hurricane." The next moment, it was circling the aerodrome, lowering its wheels to land.
"Who is it?"
said the fair-haired Paddy.
"No one's gone out this morning."
Then, as it glided past us onto the runway, we saw the number on the tail of the machine, H4427, and we knew that it was Finn. We were standing up now and watching the machine as it taxied toward us. And when it came up close and swung around for parking, we saw Finn in the cockpit. He waved his hand at us, grinned, and got out. We ran up and shouted at him, "Where have you been? Where in the hell have you been? Did you force land and get away again? Did you find a woman in Beirut? Finn, where in the hell have you been?" Others were coming up and crowding around him now, fitters and riggers and the men who drove the fire tender, and they all waited to hear what Finn would say. He stood there, pulling off his helmet, pushing back his black hair with his hand, and he was so astonished at our behaviour that at first he merely looked at us and did not speak. Then he laughed and said, "What in the hell's the matter? What in the hell's the matter with all of you? Where have you been?" we shouted. "Where have you been for 2 days?" Upon the face of Finn there was a great and enormous astonishment. He looked quickly at his watch. 5 past 12, he said. "I left at 11, 1 hour and 5 minutes ago. Don't be a lot of damn fools. I must go and report quickly. The Navy will want to know that those destroyers are still in the harbour at Beirut." He started to walk away. I caught his arm. "Finn," I said quietly, "you've been away since the day before yesterday. What's the matter with you?" He looked at me and laughed. "I've seen you organise much better jokes than this one," he said. "It isn't so funny. It isn't a bit funny." And he walked away. We stood there. The stag, Paddy, and I. The fitters, the riggers, and the men who drove the fire engine, watching Finn as he walked away. We looked at each other, not knowing what to say or to think, understanding nothing, knowing nothing except that Finn had been serious when he spoke, and that what he said he had believed to be true. We knew this because we knew Finn, and we knew it because when one has been together, as we had been together, there is never any doubting of anything that anyone says when he is talking about his flying. There can only be a doubting of oneself. These men were doubting themselves, standing there in the sun doubting themselves, and the stag was standing by the wing of Finn's machine, peeling off with his fingers little flakes of paint, which dried up and cracked in the sun. Someone said, "Well, I'll be buggered." And the men turned and started to walk quietly back to their jobs. The next three pilots on readiness came walking slowly towards us from the grey corrugated iron hangar, walking slowly under the heat of the sun and swinging their helmets in their hands as they came. The stag, Paddy, and I walked over to the pilots' mess to have a drink and lunch. The mess was a small white wooden building with a veranda. Inside there were two rooms, one a sitting room with armchairs and magazines and a hole in the wall through which you could buy drinks, and the other a dining room with one long wooden table. In the sitting room we found Finn talking to Monkey, our CO. The other pilots were sitting around listening and everybody was drinking beer. We knew that it was really a serious business in spite of the beer and the armchairs, that Monkey was doing what he had to do and doing it in the only way possible. Monkey was a rare man, tall with a handsome face, an Italian bullet wound in his leg, and a casual, friendly efficiency. He never laughed out loud. He just choked and grunted deep in his throat. Finn was saying, "You must go easy, Monkey. You must help me to stop thinking that I've gone mad." Finn was being serious and sensible, but he was worried as hell. "I have told you all I know," he said, "that I took off at 11 o'clock, that I climbed up high, that I flew to Beirut, saw the two French destroyers, and came back, landing at 12:05. I swear to you, that is all I know." He looked around at us, at the stag and me, at Paddy and Johnny and the half-dozen other pilots in the room. And we smiled at him and nodded to show him that we were with him, not against him, and that we believed what he said. Monkey said, "What in the hell am I going to say to headquarters at Jerusalem? I reported you missing. Now I've got to report your return, and insist on knowing where you've been." The whole thing was getting to be too much for Finn. He was sitting upright, tapping with the fingers of his left hand on the leather arm of his chair, tapping with quick, sharp taps, leaning forward, thinking, thinking, fighting to think, tapping on the arm of the chair, and then he began tapping the floor with his foot as well. The stag could stand it no longer. "Monkey," he said, "Monkey, let's just leave it all for a bit. Let's leave it and perhaps Finn will remember something later on." Paddy, who was sitting on the arm of the stag's chair, said, Yes, and meanwhile, we could tell HQ that Finn had force-landed in a field in Syria, taken 2 days to repair his aircraft, then flown home. Everybody was helping Finn. The pilots were all helping him. In the mind of each of us was the certain knowledge that there was something that concerned us greatly. Finn knew it, although that was all he knew, and the others knew it because one could see it upon their faces. There was a tension, a fine, high-drawn tension in the room, because here for the first time was something which was neither bullets, nor fire, nor the coughing of an engine, nor burst tires, nor blood in the cockpit, nor yesterday, nor today, nor even tomorrow. Monkey felt it too, and he said,
Yes. Let's have another drink and leave it for a bit. I'll tell HQ that you force-landed in Syria and managed to get off again later.
We had some more beer and went into lunch. Monkey ordered bottles of Palestine white wine with the meal to celebrate Finn's return. After that, no one mentioned the thing at all. We did not even talk about it when Finn wasn't there. But each one of us continued to think about it secretly, knowing for certain that it was something important and that it was not finished. The tension spread quickly through the squadron, and was with all the pilots. Meanwhile, the days went by, and the sun shone upon the aerodrome, and upon the aircraft, and Finn took his place among us flying in the normal way. Then one day, I think it was about a week later, we did another ground strafe for Ryak Aerodrome. There were 6 of us, with Monkey leading, and Finn flying on his starboard side. We came in low over Ryak, and there was plenty of light flak, and as we went in on the first run, Paddy's machine was hit. As we wheeled for the second run, we saw his Hurricane wing gently over and dive straight to the ground at the edge of the aerodrome. There was a great billow of white smoke as it hit, then the flames, and as the flames spread, the smoke turned from white to black, and Paddy was with it. Immediately, there was a crackle over the radio, and I heard Finn's voice, very excited, shouting into his microphone, shouting, I've remembered it! Hello, Monkey! I've remembered it all! And Monkey's calm, slow reply,
Okay. Finn, okay. Don't forget it.
We did our second run, and then Monkey led us quickly away, weaving in and out of the valleys, with the bare, grey, brown hills far above us on either side. And all the way home, all through the half-hour's flight, Finn never stopped shouting over the RT. First, he would call to Monkey and say, Hello, Monkey, I've remembered it, all of it, every bit of it. Then he would say, Hello, Stag, I've remembered it, all of it, I can't forget it now. He called me, and he called Johnny, and he called Wishful. He called us all separately over and over again, and he was so excited that sometimes he shouted too loudly into his mic, and we could not hear what he was saying. When we landed, we dispersed our aircraft, and because Finn for some reason had to park his at the far side of the aerodrome, the rest of us were in the operations room before him. The ops room was beside the hangar. It was a bare place, with a large table in the middle of the floor on which there was a map of the area. There was another, smaller table, with a couple of telephones, a few wooden chairs and benches, and at one end the floor was stacked with Mae Wests, parachutes and helmets. We were standing there taking off our flying clothing and throwing it onto the floor at the end of the room when Finn arrived. He came quickly into the doorway and stopped. His black hair was standing up straight and untidy because of the way in which he had pulled off his helmet. His face was shiny with sweat, and his khaki shirt was dark and wet. His mouth was open and he was breathing quickly. He looked as though he had been running. He looked like a child who had rushed downstairs into a room full of grown-ups to say that the cat has had kittens in the nursery and who does not know how to begin. We had all heard him coming because that was what we had been waiting for. Everyone stopped what they were doing and stood still, looking at Finn. Monkey said, Hello, Finn. And Finn said, Monkey, you've got to believe this because it's what happened. Monkey was standing over by the table with the telephones. The stag was near him. Square, short, ginger-haired stag. Standing up straight, holding a Mae West in his hand, looking at Finn. The others were at the far end of the room. When Finn spoke, they began to move up quietly until they were closer to him. Until they had reached the edge of the big map table, which they touched with their hands. There they stood, looking at Finn, and waiting for him to begin. He started at once, talking quickly, then calming down and talking more slowly as he got into his story. He told everything, standing there by the door of the ops room, with his yellow Mae West still on him and with his helmet and oxygen mask in his hand. The others stayed where they were and listened, and as I listened to him, I forgot that it was Finn speaking, and that we were in the ops room at Haifa. I forgot everything, and went with him on his journey, and did not come back until he had finished.
I was flying at about 20,000, he said. I flew over Tyre and Sidon, and over the Damer River, and then I flew inland, over the Lebanon hills, because I intended to approach Beirut from the east. Suddenly I flew into cloud, thick, white cloud, which was so thick and dense that I could see nothing except the inside of my cockpit. I couldn't understand it, because a moment before everything had been clear and blue, and there had been no cloud anywhere. I started to lose height, to get out of the cloud, and I went down and down, and still I was in it. I knew that I must not go too low because of the hills, but at 6,000 the cloud was still around me. It was so thick that I could see nothing, not even the nose of my machine, nor the wings, and the cloud condensed on the windshield, and little rivers of water ran down the glass and got blown away by the slipstream. I have never seen cloud like that before. It was thick and white, right up to the edge of the cockpit. I felt like a man on a magic carpet, sitting there alone in this little glass-topped cockpit, with no wings, no tail, no engine, and no aeroplane. And I knew that I must get out of this cloud. So I turned and flew west over the sea, away from the mountains, and then I came down low by my altimeter. I came down to 500 feet, 400, 300, 200, 100, and the cloud was still around me. For a moment I paused. I knew that it was unsafe to go lower. Then, quite suddenly, like a gust of wind, came the feeling that there was nothing below me. No sea, nor earth, nor anything else. And slowly, deliberately, I opened the throttle, pushed the stick hard forward, and dived. I did not watch the altimeter. I looked straight ahead, through the windshield, at the whiteness of the cloud, and I went on diving. I sat there, pressing the stick forward, keeping her in the dive, watching the vast, clinging whiteness of the cloud, and I never once wondered where I was going. I just went. I do not know how long I sat there. It may have been minutes, and it may have been hours. I know only that as I sat there and kept her diving, I was certain that what was below me was neither mountains, nor rivers, nor earth, nor sea, and I was not afraid. Then I was blinded. It was like being half asleep in bed when someone turns on the light. I came out of the clouds so suddenly and so quickly that I was blinded. There was no space of time between being in it and being out of it. One moment I was in it, and the whiteness was thick around me, and in that same moment I was out of it, and the light was so bright that I was blinded. I screwed up my eyes and held them tight closed for several seconds. When I opened them, everything was blue. More blue than anything I had ever seen. It was not a dark blue, nor was it a bright blue. It was a blue blue, a pure, shining color which I had never seen before, and which I cannot describe. I looked around. I looked up above me and behind me. I sat up and peered below me through the glass of the cockpit, and everywhere it was blue. It was bright and clear, like pleasant sunlight, but there was no sun. Then I saw them. Far ahead and above, I saw a long, thin line of aircraft flying across the sky. They were moving forward in a single black line, all at the same speed, all in the same direction, all close up, following one behind the other, and the lines stretched across the sky as far as the eye could see. It was the way they moved ahead, the urgent way in which they pressed forward, 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 like ships sailing before a great wind. It was from this that I knew everything. I do not know why or how I knew it, but I knew, as I looked at them, that these were the pilots and air crews who had been killed in battle, who now, in their own aircraft, were making their last flight, their last journey. As I flew higher and closer, I could recognize the machines themselves. I saw in that long procession nearly every type there was. I saw Lancasters and Dorniers, Halifaxes and Hurricanes, Messerschmitts, Spitfires, Stirlings, Savoy 79s, Junker 88s, Gladiators, Hamptons, Mackey 200s, Blenheims, Focke-Wulfs, Bowfighters, Swordfish and Heinkels. All these and many more I saw, and the moving line reached across the blue sky both to the one side and to the other until it faded from sight. I was close to them now, and I began to sense that I was being sucked towards them regardless of what I wished to do. There was a wind which took hold of my machine, blew it over and tossed it about like a leaf, and I was pulled and sucked as by a giant vortex towards the other airplanes. There was nothing I could do, for I was in the vortex and in the arms of the wind. This all happened very quickly. I remember it clearly. I felt a pull on my aircraft becoming stronger. I was whisked forward faster and faster, and then suddenly, I was flying in the procession itself, moving forward with the others, at the same speed and on the same course. Ahead of me, close enough for me to see the colour of the paint on its wings, was a swordfish, an old Fleet Air Arm swordfish. I could see the heads and helmets of the observer and the pilot as they sat in their cockpits, the one behind the other. Ahead of the swordfish there was a Dornier, a flying pencil, and beyond the Dornier there were others which I could not recognize from where I was. We flew on and on. I could not have turned and flown away, even if I had wanted to. I do not know why, although it may have been something to do with the vortex and with the wind, but I knew that it was so. Moreover, I was not really flying my aircraft. It flew itself. There was no maneuvering to reckon with. No speed, no height, no throttle, no stick, no nothing. Once I glanced down at my instruments and saw that they were all dead, just as they are when the machine is sitting on the ground. So we flew on. I had no idea how fast we went. There was no sensation of speed, and for all I know, it was a million miles an hour. Now I come to think of it, I never once during that time felt either hot or cold or hungry or thirsty. I felt none of those things. I felt no fear because I knew nothing of which to be afraid. I felt no worry because I could remember nothing or think of nothing about which to be worried. I felt no desire to do anything that I was not doing or to have anything that I did not have because there was nothing that I wished to do and there was nothing that I wished to have. I felt only pleasure at being where I was, at seeing the wonderful light and the beautiful color around me. Once I caught sight of my face in the cockpit mirror, and I saw that I was smiling, smiling with my eyes and with my mouth. And when I looked away, I knew that I was still smiling, simply because that was the way I felt. Once, the observer in the swordfish ahead of me turned and waved his hand. I slid back the roof of my cockpit and waved back. I remember that even when I opened the cockpit, there was no rush of air and no rush of cold or heat, nor was there any pressure of the slipstream on my hand. Then I noticed they were all waving at each other like children on a roller coaster, and I turned and waved at the man in the Mackie behind me. But there was something happening along the line. Far up in front of me, I could see that the aeroplanes had changed course, were wheeling around to the left and losing height. The whole procession, as it reached a certain point, was banking around and gliding downwards in a wide, sweeping circle. Instinctively, I glanced down over the cockpit, and there I saw spread out below me a vast green plain. It was green and smooth and beautiful. It reached to the far edges of the horizon, where the blue of the sky came down and merged with the green of the plain. And there was a light. Over to the left, far away in the distance, was a bright white light, shining bright without any colour. It was as though the sun, but something far bigger than the sun, something without shape or form, whose light was bright but not blinding, was lying on the far edge of the green plain. The light spread outwards from a centre of brilliance, and it spread far up into the sky and far out over the plain. When I saw it, I could not at first look away from it. I had a desire to go towards it, into it, and almost at once the desire and the longing became so intense that several times I tried to pull my aircraft out of the line and fly straight towards it, but it was not possible and I had to fly with the rest. As they banked around and lost height, I went with them, and we began to glide down towards the green plain below. Now that I was closer, I could see the great mass of aircraft upon the plain itself. They were everywhere, scattered over the ground like currants upon a green carpet. There were hundreds and hundreds of them, and each minute, each second almost, their numbers grew as those in front of me landed and taxied to a standstill. Quickly we lost height. Soon I saw that the ones just in front of me were lowering their wheels and preparing to land. The Dornier, next but one to me, levelled off and touched down. Then the old Swordfish. The pilot turned a little to the left out of the way of the Dornier and landed beside him. I turned to the left of the Swordfish and levelled off. I looked out of the cockpit at the ground, judging the height, and I saw the green of the ground blurred as it rushed past me and below me. I waited for my aircraft to sink and to touch down. It seemed to take a long time. "Come on," I said, "come on, come on." I was only about 6 feet up, but she would not sink. "Get down," I shouted, "please get down." I began to panic. I became frightened. Suddenly I noticed that I was gaining speed. I cut all the switches, but it made no difference. The aircraft was gathering speed, going faster and faster. I looked around and saw behind me the long procession of aircraft dropping down out of the sky and sweeping into land. I saw the mass of machines upon the ground, scattered far across the plain, and away on one side I saw the light, shining white light, which shone so brightly over the great plain and to which I longed to go. I know that had I been able to land, I would have started to run towards that light the moment I got out of my aircraft. I know I was flying away from it. My fear grew. As I flew faster and farther away, the fear took hold of me until soon I was fighting crazy mad, pulling at the stick, wrestling with the aeroplane, trying to turn it around back towards the light. When I saw that it was impossible, I tried to kill myself. I really wanted to kill myself then. I tried to dive the aircraft into the ground, but it flew on straight. I tried to jump out of the cockpit, but there was a hand upon my shoulder which held me down. I tried to bang my head against the sides of the cockpit, but it made no difference, and I sat there fighting with my machine and with everything until suddenly I noticed that I was in cloud. I was in the same thick white cloud as before, and I seemed to be climbing. I looked behind me, but the cloud had closed in all around. There was nothing now but this vast, impenetrable whiteness. I began to feel sick and giddy. I did not care any longer what happened one way or the other. I just sat there limply, letting the machine fly on by itself. It seemed a long time, and I am sure that I sat there for many hours. I must have gone to sleep. As I slept, I dreamed. I dreamed not of the things that I had just seen, but of the things of my ordinary life, of the squadron, of Nicky, and of the aerodrome here at Haifa. I dreamed I was sitting at readiness outside the hangar with two others, that a request came from the Navy for someone to do a quick reco over Beirut. And because I was first up, I jumped into my Hurricane and went off. I dreamed that I passed over Tyre and Sidon and over the Damour River, climbing up to 20,000 as I went. Then I turned inland over the Lebanon hills, swung around, and approached Beirut from the east. I was above the town, peering over the side of the cockpit, looking for the harbour and trying to find the two French destroyers. Soon I saw them clearly,
tied up close alongside each other by the wharf, and I banked around and dived for home as fast as I could. The Navy's wrong, I thought to myself as I flew back. The destroyers are still in the harbour. I looked at my watch. 1.5 hours. I've been quick, I said. They'll be pleased. I tried to call up on the radio to give the information, but I couldn't get through. And then I came back here. When I landed, you all crowded around me and asked me where I had been for 2 days, but I could remember nothing. I did not remember anything except the flight to Beirut until just now, when I saw Paddy being shot down. As his machine hit the ground, I found myself saying, "You lucky bastard. You lucky, lucky bastard." And as I said it, I knew why I was saying it and remembered everything. That was when I shouted to you over the radio. That was when I remembered. Finn had finished. No one had moved or said anything all the time that he had been talking. Now it was only Monkey who spoke. He shuffled his feet on the floor, turned, and looked out of the window and said quietly, almost in a whisper, "Well, I'll be damned." And the rest of us went slowly back to the business of taking off our flying clothing and stacking it in the corner of the room on the floor. All except the stag. Square, short stag, who stood there watching Finn as Finn walked slowly across the room to put away his clothing. After Finn's story, the squadron returned to normal. The tension, which had been with us for over a week, disappeared. The aerodrome was a happier place in which to be, but no one ever mentioned Finn's journey. We never once spoke about it together, not even when we got drunk in the evening at the Excelsior in Haifa. The Syrian campaign was coming to an end. Everyone could see that it must finish soon, although the Vichy people were still fighting fiercely south of Beirut. We were still flying. We were flying a great deal over the fleet which was bombarding the coast, for we had the job of protecting them from the Junker 88s which came over from Rhodes. It was on the last one of these flights over the fleet that Finn was killed. We were flying high above the ships when the JU 88s came over in force, and there was a battle. We had only 6 Hurricanes in the air. There were many of the Junkers, and it was a good fight. I do not remember much about what went on at the time. One never does. But I remember that it was a hectic, chasing fight, with the Junkers diving for the ships, with the ships barking at them, throwing up everything into the air so that the sky was full of white flowers which blossomed quickly and grew and blew away with the wind. I remember the German who blew up in mid-air, quickly, with just a white flash, so that where the bomber had been, there was nothing left except tiny little pieces falling slowly downwards. I remember the one that had its rear turret shot away, which flew along with the gunner hanging out of the tail by his straps, struggling to get back into the machine. I remember one, a brave one, who stayed up above to fight us while the others went down to dive bomb. I remember that we shot him up, and I remember seeing him turn slowly over onto his back, pale green belly upwards like a dead fish, before he finally spun down. And I remember Finn. I was close to him when his aircraft caught fire. I could see the flames coming out of the nose of his machine and dancing over the engine cowling. There was black smoke coming from the exhaust of his Hurricane. I flew up close, and I called to him over the RT. "Hello, Finn," I called. "You better jump." His voice came back, calm and slow. "It's not so easy." "Jump," I shouted. "Jump, quickly." I could see him sitting there under the glass roof of the cockpit. He looked towards me and shook his head. "It's not so easy," he answered. "I'm a bit shot up. My arms are shot up, and I can't undo the straps." "Get out," I shouted. "For God's sake, get out!" But he did not answer. For a moment his aircraft flew on, straight and level. Then gently, like a dying eagle, it dipped a wing and dived towards the sea. I watched it as it went. I watched the thin trail of black smoke which it made across the sky. And as I watched, Finn's voice came again over the radio, clear and slow.
I'm a lucky bastard, he was saying. A lucky, lucky bastard.